I'm happy to introduce Katarina Nokun. She is a she's a private CE activist, and she worked for the Federation of German Consumer Organization and also for the German Working Group on Data Retention. She was on the board of the German Pirate Party, and nowadays she's working for Campact as a campaigner for digital rights. Campact is an online petition platform here in Germany. But also, she's an economist, and she did some research on why it is so difficult for decentralized social networks to compete with Facebook. So it's the perfect talk for the mission statement of this Congress. Katarina Nokun.
Yeah, thank you very much for this awesome introduction. And first of all, I need to excuse myself. I catch the cold, so just imagine that I'm shouting at you all the time because I can't. Yeah, why did I do some research on the topic of Facebook and diaspora? You know, I really hate Facebook. During my time at the Federal Consumer Organization of Germany, we sued Facebook a lot. We also sued Google a lot. And when I studied economics, friends of me asked me, yeah, let's found a Facebook group and there we can exchange exams. And that's so cool. That's so awesome. And I said, yeah, well, no, I don't have a Facebook account and I don't want to. And then I asked, it worked out fine. We opened a group on weriseup.net, so we exchanged our exams there. But still, I asked myself, why can't I convince more people to join Diaspora or other networks? And that's why I did this research project. So let's talk about gated communities and the internet. The internet is based on large parts on free protocols, so everything is okay, isn't it? Oh. Okay, everything is okay. Okay. Yeah, and in the beginning of the internet, there were many, many nodes, and they were connected to one another as equals. And today, the internet is a giant web, which is interconnected with more and more aspects of our lives. But what started as a playground for nerds and scientists is not only today a powerful economic driving force that changes a lot of aspects of how economics work, how politics work, and how public debates work, but it also changed in a way I really dislike. The main topic of this Congress is gated communities, and I think it's a very important issue to address, that above this open layer of the internet, above this open protocol, gated closed islands of gated communities emerged, and we see clear that there is a trend for concentration in the hands of just a few platform owners. So what can we do about it? I think social networks are an important benchmark for this trend. And as an economist, I have a clear word for what is happening right now in many areas on the web. It's market failure. Because there is no real competition possible with Facebook. There is no real competition possible with other large platforms. And that's why this talk will try to explain why we should care that Facebook has become the de facto social network provider for large parts of the world, and how this came about, and most importantly, what lessons we can draw from certain dynamics on the market for market entry options for decentralized social networks. So first of all, why should we care? Some numbers. If Facebook was a state, it would have more inhabitants than Europe, China, or the Americas. And every fifth human being on this planet logs in on Facebook at least once per month. That's an incredible number. And the reason for the success of social networks as an idea is because it connects to a very basic human need for us, because we are social creatures. So I think addressing this human need that we are social, that we want to exchange, to share with one another, is an incredible, cool, powerful idea. And social networks, most importantly, add context to content. It makes a difference. If a friend of mine shares an article about Star Wars, how stupid the new Star Wars movie is, then some journalist just writes an article about it. Yeah? And social networks are so important for us because the web is filled with information about everything. And social networks allow us to filter this information through social ties. And it's not only the place where we can spread birthday messages. Happy birthday, I thought about you because Facebook reminded me I should do so. But Facebook is also the place where we can found groups, where we can not only exchange maybe exams for economics classes, but where we can call for action and organize protests. And back then, when I studied in Hamburg, there was a point where I registered on Facebook under a fake name. It was I was called Maria Musterfrau, and this Maria Musterfrau founded different events on Facebook for demonstration against the ACTA Treaty. ACTA. It was a treaty. it had a lot to do with copyrights and also in some areas with privacy issues. And we called for action on the web, and 15,000 people came to our demonstration in Hamburg. So basically, I think social networks are a very, very powerful idea to enhance democracy, freedom of speech. But unfortunately, I don't think that the structure of Facebook as the de facto social network provider of the world is the best way to provide this idea to the people. So we heard a lot on TV, on the newspapers, about the Facebook revolution, how the Facebook revolution would empower democracy and so on, and freedom of speech. And in fact, for generations, media institutions such as TV channels or newspapers were the gatekeepers for public debates. If you wanted to influence public debates, you needed to get past these gatekeepers. And it is true that the internet or social media allowed to implement setting a topic from bottom up, and that is a very powerful idea. But this tale of the power of Facebook as an enabler or catalyst for freedom of speech, I think it's really a tale. It's a very simplified story, because the inconvenient truth is that today, if you want to influence public debates, you have new gatekeepers. And Facebook is one of the most important gatekeepers of our time. Take, for instance, secret algorithms which filter information that is revealed to us not on the basis which information we want to see, but on assumed click and interaction rates, yeah, based on economic incentives, because they want to make money out of this interaction. Facebook thereby creates virtual filter bubbles around us. It's not only that we can filter information through our social ties, but Facebook sits in the middle as bottleneck for information and control whether or not this is really provided to us. And most importantly, Facebook decides which content is allowed on its network and which content is banned. Take, for instance, the case of nudity, or take the example of violence. Facebook is much, much more liberal to depict violence on its network than nudity. For example, when you have a mother feeding a child, this Facebook is more likely to be banned than someone beating someone else up. And if you ask Kurdish activists on the topic what they think about freedom of speech on Facebook, they will tell you a pretty different tale than we see on the media when they talk about the Facebook revolution. Because during the last years, there were several cases where President Erdogan, the Turkish prime minister, addressed Facebook because he wanted to have some profiles of activists or parties banned, and Facebook complied. And talking about social network, it's not only about freedom of speech. One of the most important topics, I think, is also the issue of privacy. And for me, privacy, the decisive privacy struggles are not whether or not someone sees our selfies on Facebook, because I guess most people want that other people see their selfies on Facebook. For me, the decisive struggles are rather about our browser history that Facebook collects through like buttons. It's about connection information. It's about our search queries and the right to register under a fake name. Because what I did back then when I organized demonstration in Hamburg, that was clearly illegal. You are not allowed to register under a fake name. And what would have happened if Facebook decided one day or 2 days before the demonstration was launched, or maybe before that, let's delete this account, let's delete this event, we would have a problem. And based on the information on which profiles we click, our provider knows with whom we are in love and whether or not we moved on after a breakup. That are pretty important information about us. And we should never forget that the information that is stored in order to sell us cars and diamonds and fancy stuff can also be used in order to target activists. And in the wrong hands, this data on activists is pretty dangerous. So as we see, there is a clear conflict between shareholder value and public interest. And I do not have a problem with social network. As I told you, I love the idea, but I do have a problem when we put corporations in this in a position to exploit this very sensitive part of our lives. Yeah, but fortunately, there is an alternative. In 2010, four young students from the US launched a crowdfunding project on Kickstarter. And they asked for $10,000 in order to change their internships and summer jobs for the opportunity to work full-time on a decentralized, open-source alternative for social networks. And the reaction was really stunning, because they asked for $10,000, and what they got in the end, after 39 days, was 20 times more than they asked for. It was $200,000. And what was the goal of the diaspora? The founders wanted to give the users, first of all, a better bargaining position against the dominant social media or social network provider. They wanted to give users more control over their data, and they wanted to implement a structure for social networks that provides a better control against censorship and control of governments. So what does it mean? A decentralized social network. To talk about the issue of centralization or decentralization is important because a lot of the power structure between users and the platform owners can be foreseen somehow through the technical infrastructure that is implemented. And you can say that there are three basic kinds of different network structures, which be centralized, decentralized, and distributed. In the centralized design, which is represented, for instance, by Facebook, there is one network platform owner in the middle, like a spider in the web, collecting all the data. He's the bottleneck. You can't go besides this bottleneck in order to communicate with other members of a platform. In contrast to that, a fully distributed system would be like, well, is a peer-to-peer system, where every user is at the same time a node of a network. So again, it's a network of equals. But unfortunately, it's a bit tricky to provide a distributed social network on large scale because, as you can imagine, you would need encryption on a large scale because otherwise every other member of the network would have the potential to access your private data. And there are some projects researching on that, but in 2010, when Diaspora was founded, the idea was to start with a decentralized structure. And the most important feature of such a decentralized structure is that you don't have one server where every interaction is going through, but you have different servers. And because it's open source, everyone is free to set up their own server, or you as a user can maybe choose, I trust person X and she's running a Diaspora pod and I join, or I don't trust anyone and I set up my own pod. And talking about freedom of speech or government pressure, one interesting feature is that it's much, much more difficult to censor or to control data flows from government level in a decentralized or distributed system, because if there is a server under pressure, you just can move to another server. This slide shows what's the state of Diaspora right now. We have we live in the year 2015. Some years passed since this this idea was announced, and here you see the top 10 active Diaspora servers, or they are also called pods. And first of all, we see that in the last years there was a development, or a trend, that more and more servers are located in Germany. The biggest server once, or the most active server once, was joindiaspora.com, which was the first server that called for registration for anyone. And today, most servers are in Germany. And looking at the number of registered users, you see that the top 10 Diaspora pods together have round about 500,000 users. So anyone who's telling you Diaspora is dead, you can tell Diaspora is not dead. It's pretty alive. And there are round about between 20 and 30,000 people who log into the Diaspora network or connected networks at least once per month. And this number is rather increasing over the last years. So we see that Diaspora has a relatively small but stable user base. But in the end, when we look at the what was announced, we see that it's clearly failed its goal to overcome Facebook or to overthrow Facebook as the de facto social network of the world. So we need to ask ourselves, why didn't this happen? And in IT, it's said that code is law, and in economics, it's said that the market structures are telling you a lot about which outcome is most likely to come out of a situation on the market. That means that market structure are a powerful tool that can provide some explanations why we live in such a decade of gated communities and why decentralized alternatives struggle so hard to overcome Facebook and others. And talking about market structures or features of certain markets, the most important feature on the market for social networks is, of course, the network effect. So what's the network effect? Imagine you get a very tempting offer for a mobile contract, and it offers really everything you were craving for, different features, a new mobile for free, and a very, very low competitive price. But there's just one twist with this offer. The operator tells you, well, you can accept this offer, but the problem is you can only communicate with other members of our network. Everyone else will be banned from calling you or being called. Would you accept such an offer? Would you join a gated community? I don't think so. I wouldn't. And this example shows really what the network effect is all about. The global network effect means simply that the more users join a network, the more connections are available, and therefore the more attractive it becomes for other people to join. So more people join, more people join, more people join. And therefore it's a structure that really empowers the growth of monopolies or big platforms. And through this bandwagon effect with positive feedback loops, you can clearly see that monopolies are enforced. But talking about social networks, the global effect is really not so important, I think. Because when I think about social networks or communication platforms, I really don't care about the market share in China or in Brazil or in the US. I care about the market share among my friends. I care about on which platform I can reach my family or my business contacts. And that's true for a lot of people. I mean, most people communicate intensely, always with a very small subset of people. And that is how the local network effect works. If everyone here in this room or if everyone I'm friends with, rather to say, would switch to an alternative platform, I would follow, always, because I want to reach these people. And interestingly, the success of Facebook was not so much about the global network effect. This effect came later. First of all, it was about the local network effect. Because when Facebook emerged, they had a certain strategy for growth. First of all, Facebook was in the first months or year only available for Harvard students. You even needed a valid Harvard University address in order to register. Everyone else was banned from the network. So imagine this situation. You are new at the university, and most likely you moved to Harvard. You don't know anyone there. But you make new friends, and all these new friends are on this platform. So you know you will meet people you want to meet there, so you join. And only after having reached a critical mass in Harvard, Facebook expanded to other Ivy League colleges. These are very prestigious colleges in the US, and you can be really lucky if you are accepted at one of these colleges. And again, you needed a valid university address in order to register, and everyone else was banned. And only after they reached a critical mass there, they expanded and allowed any university student to log in. Then they expanded again and allowed any school or any member of a school to join. Then they chose several institutions, which were also allowed to join. And only after they reached a critical mass in every of these communities, they opened for the general public. And that is how social networks, or also different kinds of networks, which are based on communication, how they grow. And this strategy is successful because people who joined early on Facebook knew that they would find meaningful connections there, not anyone. As I told you, you don't care about the market share in China. You care about the market share maybe on the CCC Congress, or maybe at your local hackerspace, or maybe at your school or university, or at work, or at your soccer club. Well, and Facebook was not the only network that understood how important these local network effects are in order to grow. You often find invite-only structures, searchable friends or friends lists, or invite applications, or these fancy upload functions for your address book. It's all about the local network effect. It's all about local growth. But unfortunately, it's not only the global and the local network effect that benefits Facebook. It's also the indirect network effect, or also called cross-sided network effect. And one example, what does it mean, indirect network effect, one network effect again. Facebook opens its platform for app developers. Any app developer is free to join Facebook. Of course, you have some restrictions, but you don't need to pay money in order to place your app on Facebook. And why does Facebook act in such a way? Because the more apps you have, the more interaction you have, the more people are likely to join. And the more people join, the more apps you have, the more people will join. So you have a likelihood that more apps can contribute to growth. And maybe you don't care about apps. I know pretty much people from my time at university that were so addicted to Farmville. Or Candy Crush or whatever, but this Farmville thing really ruled at university when you look at the laptops. Another interesting cross-sided network effect is, for instance, an example where you succeed to attract more advertisers, and these more advertisers pay you more money, you use this money in order to provide better services to your users, and maybe more users join because of this. This attracts more advertisers, and so on. So this is another effect that leads to an increase in growth for the largest platform, or for large platforms. And on top of that, you still, of course, have economies of scale, like in many different other markets. Economies of scale basically mean the marginal costs for every additional user just decreases. And of course, this doesn't make competition any easier. And at this point, it is to understand, talking about Facebook as a gated community, how it came about that it is, in fact, today a gated community. Because it wouldn't, if Facebook would provide, for example, open standards and the ability to interconnect between different networks. Imagine a situation where you just could join Diaspora and you still could contact all your contacts from Facebook. How much more people would then switch from Facebook to Diaspora? I think this number would be pretty high. And some of you may think this is like a total naive dream of open standards and social networks, but I guess every one of you has an email address. And do you care which provider your communication partner chooses? I mean, you don't need to care because it's an open protocol. As long as this person uses the email technology, you can communicate with. And the issues of whether or not a communication platform shuts down and uses proprietary standards and maybe implements incompatibility on purpose is because that standards have the power to change the reference point for the network effect. As I told you with the example of email, the relevant number concerning the local and the global network effect with email is not the number who's on Gmail or the number of people who uses GMX or T-Online, whatever there is. But the relevant number is really who uses this technology. And that is why there are very high incentives. Once you became a big player because of the global network effect, the local network effect, the indirect network effect, just to close your gates and shut your competitors out. And it won't get better, in fact, it will get worse. For example, we see a lot of companies that in the beginning provide pretty open standards or invite application writers to write mobile applications such as Twitter, but at some point they always close down. Once Facebook shares what was compatible with Jabber, and the Google chat was compatible with Jabber with XMPP too, but at some point they just decided to close down. And if you compete with a gated community, this means also something else. It means that a new feature won't help you that much when you try to get users to switch. Because maybe, for example, they will imagine a new social network with a fancy feature and everyone says, oh, I like this feature, but at the same time, a lot of people will say, yeah, I like this feature, but still it's more important to communicate with all of my friends. This gives you time. Of course, people are more likely to switch, but you have time to adapt as a monopolist, as a big platform in order to copy these features or maybe to buy the whole company like Facebook does frequently. And it becomes more likely with the possibility just to close up your community and make gated community out of it, that the first mover on the market will take it all. The first company or the first platform that manages to get a critical mass and shuts down is most likely to become the de facto platform provider for all of the users. But unfortunately, these are not all the economic effects that make it less likely that people leave Facebook. There are still the switching costs and the login effects. Imagine you want to leave from Facebook. You have all your photos there, you have all your contacts there, you have interaction data, and maybe you can move some of your photos, but it's incredibly annoying when you don't have data portability in place. And there are some data which are really lost. You can't take them with you. And that is why switching is so hard. And the longer you are a member of such a platform, which doesn't allow you just to take your stuff when you move out, the more you become locked in. And the problem about the situation is once the operator knows that you won't be very likely someone who just switches, he will care less. He will care less when you complain about the new terms of services. He will care less when you complain about privacy issues or the advertisement policy or whatever. He will just don't give a shit. Yeah, and the problem is, once you have a gated community, you of course want to monetize it. And the less likely users can make a credible threat to leave in case they don't like the business model or like the way how their data or they themselves are treated, the more you can just take out of this network. Because people will start to tolerate things they would never tolerate under other conditions. In the case of email, I would just switch my email provider. In the case of Facebook, most people won't switch the social network. In the business model of Facebook, we are not the consumers. That's very important to keep in mind. We are the product being sold, and advertisers pay for the really, really scarce resource on the internet. It's access to the users. It's our attention. And here's some data on how much worth or how much revenue is generated per user. And you see that when you are from the US or Canada, your data per month, per year, is worth approximately $8. So you pay such an amount of money for getting a service that costs the provider approximately some pennies because of economies of scale. So that's why gated communities are everywhere. It's a gold mine. And the problem is talking about platforms such as Facebook. We are not talking anymore about just social networks because it's a platform. And platforms that have the network effects and login on their site try often to transfer their dominant market position from one market to another market. And one common strategy is bundling. Bundling appears when you only can get a certain service as a bundle of services, and you can't just get a single service without the whole bundle. Some examples concerning Facebook. Why do you need Jabber when you have a Facebook chat that can't even communicate with Jabber? Or do you really need Skype when you have Google Hangouts on your Google Plus account? Or, for example, would you still upload videos on YouTube or Vimeo when you want to spread them via Facebook and you know that Facebook systematically downgrades every video that isn't uploaded on their servers? And this strategy has devastating results. It's causing that the gates or the borders of the gated communities are constantly expanding. That means larger and larger parts of the internet are becoming parts of some gated community. And Facebook and others even have managed to kill net neutrality in various countries in order to expand their borders to the level of internet access. The fight about net neutrality is nothing else. The fight about net neutrality is about gated communities that try to expand their borders to a level where they don't belong, and they had no power until now. And it is sad to see, but for many people, like for many people I met on university back then when I studied here, Facebook is the internet. Because Facebook provides everything they basically need. Everything but freedom and privacy and choice. I admit this was a pretty depressing overview of our market structures. So let's see, what do we know with, what do we do with this knowledge, and what has it to do with Diaspora, the alternative social network? First of all, let me say one thing. I know it is a convenient dream that one day the next big social network or the next big free software project will come and rescue us all from the dominance of platform owners. But competing with such giant platforms like Google, Facebook, or Apple, or Microsoft, it's not very likely that this will happen overnight. And I love heroes, I love superheroes, I love comics, but unfortunately, this is not realistic in such a situation. We need to work hard in order to accomplish that. And a cool feature will not change this, because the history showed that every time Diaspora tried to implement a new feature in order to compete with Facebook, we had the situation that other social networks instantly copied this feature. For example, how many of you, I don't know how many of you are on Facebook, but you know, today you can differentiate on Facebook between friends, close friends, business contacts, and so on. This is a relatively new feature. And first, interestingly, Diaspora implemented such a differentiation of contact levels and called it aspects. And then Google Plus came and announced, yeah, we have something better, we have circles. And it was basically the same principle. And then Facebook, of course, copied it. So we need to face this inconvenient truth. Facebook and others will always have a bigger staff, more money, and a larger user base. And they will use it against us. So if you are dreaming that maybe there will come a new feature or a new tool, and all the teens are like, hell yeah, I want to use this. Fuck Facebook, my parents are on Facebook. This happened before. Do you know Instagram? Do you know WhatsApp? Do you know who bought it? Facebook. So we need to really think in order to win this fight, or at least to keep struggling. what are our killer features? What are the killer features of open source decentralized social networks? I just told you, open source, decentralized, non-corporate, privacy aware. Facebook will not copy that. So, you know, I got really curious because I knew that my colleagues from university are not on Diaspora. So I really got curious who is on Diaspora. Who are these 20 up to 30,000 users who log in per month? And this is an analysis of the most used hashtags on Geraspora. Geraspora is right now the most active Diaspora pod. Yeah, what kind of community do you think is on Diaspora? Top hashtags such as Linux, GNU, Hacker News, yeah? From my point of view, this is very awesome, and I think, yeah, this is a community I would like to join. So, in fact, when we remember what is important for social networks in order to grow, it's the local network effect. And, in fact, we already managed to attract a very, very specific group. And this group is not very likely to switch. Because do you think your local hackerspace would maybe switch from Diaspora to Facebook because Facebook is so awesome? I don't think so. There will be also some new features I can promptly announce because some of the developers just told me I should do. which can even make the network more attractive for groups like hackerspaces or whatever. There will be a chat extension soon, which is compatible with XMPP or based on XMPP, so that you can add all your Jabber contacts in there. And for me, it's pretty convenient because I use Jabber all the time at work. So guess what will be open all the time at work? Diaspora. Oh, here's sitting someone for my work. Okay. Because it's so super efficient. And other features are planned as well. There are other features planned as well. There shall be a group feature soon, which is not very, very easy to implement because in a decentralized network it's a bit tricky, but they are planning to do it, and they are also thinking about adding events, which is pretty awesome. For example, when you want to coordinate in your local hackerspace, in your group, and you have on your chat an idea for an event, bang, you can set it up on Diaspora. So, is this a gated community for hackers? I don't think so, because it's open, it uses open protocols, and I am sure, or I know, that there are a lot of other groups we can address with such a network in order to join, because this is how social networks expand, group by group by group. So, what other groups could like these features? What groups could, for example, dislike corporate power? What kind of activists could dislike NSA backdoors? Or what kind of public institution or even companies could feel a bit uncomfortable to put all their data on a US server? And there are some companies or institutions who really are craving for a social solution on servers they can host by themselves. And so I think it's a winning strategy to address this group, also to ask what kind of features do you want. And this is what the Diaspora community did. They asked their users, what do you want? And they said, Jabber, we want Jabber. So they implemented Jabber. And this is how we really can grow, step by step, through local network effects. And there have been interesting cooperations with the Diaspora networks or other networks that have a decentralized nature already. For example, the most active German Diaspora pod, Geraspora, is right now funded in some parts by a German newspaper, the Donaukurier. And the Donaukurier, interestingly, the Donau Kurier one day asked, they had this idea, yeah, we want maybe to experiment a bit with decentralized alternatives, we like this idea, and but they didn't want to set up a server on their own. So they decided to give regular funding, and they are still giving regular funding. Or there were requests of different groups, or even there was a request from youth workers, which were interested to use such a network for communication with their clients. Because obviously you don't want any data connecting concerning youth work hosted on Facebook. And there are these requests, they are happening, and I think this is very promising to work on this basic in order to expand group by group. And we should not forget, there are certain windows of opportunity which might convince more people that diaspora is really an awesome idea and with killer features are really worth trying it. There have been such windows of opportunity. For example, there was a time, or there was a constant time of Prime Minister Erdogan, who is banning various social media platforms in Turkey. And every time he does, the Geraspora pod sees an increased traffic from Turkish subnets. And another interesting effect is that every time Facebook announces changes in the terms of service, again, there is a peak. And these windows of opportunity, unfortunately, I have to say this, they will be more frequent in the future. Unfortunately, it happened before and it will happen again. And once you will have a big leak of data from Facebook, and this can happen anytime, maybe more people will be convinced to try a decentralized alternative. And it is also important, as these examples show, for example, from Turkey, that we need this, these alternatives right now. There are right now people who need such an alternative, not only hackerspaces. And therefore, I'm very, very, very happy that we are trying to provide such an alternative right now. Yeah, but competing with a large platform as Facebook is right now, we need also to see that this is a task we never can manage alone. We can't compete with such a network without allies at our side, which have also superpowers like we have. And one of the most interesting developments of the last year is that Diaspora is in fact not alone anymore. Diaspora is part of a so-called federation. And the federation consists of different decentralized social networks such as Diaspora, Friendica, or Red Matrix. And they are interconnected, as they speak the same protocol, so it doesn't matter whether my friends are of Friendica, on Red Matrix, or on Diaspora. I can communicate with them. And therefore, by pooling their users together, they change the reference points of the network effect. And if you are considering to launch a new social network on your own, you are free to do. And if you join the federation, you already have a user base. And this is a very, very, very exciting and powerful idea. Because the networks inside the federation are quite different. Diaspora, is, for example, has a very clean, easy design for users. And some people really like that. And the other networks have other strengths. For example, Friendica is really an interconnection machine. One of the guys who's working on the development team, he's really looking for any loophole he can get into other networks in order to establish an interconnection, even if the operator doesn't want to. And that's awesome. And for example, Friendica already speaks email protocol and Java. And Red Matrix, on the other hand, is a fork. I mean, Red Matrix and Friendica share large parts of the same code. But Red Matrix has a very, very, very strong emphasis on privacy. And they are experimenting with apps and OpenID and different features which the other networks don't provide. So I think such a federation or such a bundling of your power, such a looking for allies, is a very powerful thing to do, not only for you as a network, but also for your users. As a user, I can vote by feet. Just if I don't like Diaspora, then I just join Friendica. But I still have all my contacts from my local hackerspace, and that's awesome. And in the long run, when we look at how this works, this is really a small version of how the concept of social networks could look like if we just had open protocols. And that's also very important also for the political struggle for open protocols to provide that such a thing works. But competing with large platforms like Facebook, you are not only competing with a social network, you are competing with an alternative ecosystem. So we need really to think how to build an ecosystem on our own. And every time there is a new idea or a new feature Facebook would like to implement, they just copy it or they buy it. And the big strength of the free software movement is that we don't need monetary incentives to work together because we share similar goals. So instead of trying to provide all the features by yourself, the really winning strategy is just to stay open, just to talk to other projects in order to find maybe shared protocols or maybe find ways how you can integrate your work into another work and how you can benefit from one another. One example, when I bought this crappy Android phone, there was a pre-installed Google Plus app on it. It's disgusting, yeah, I know. But I really like the idea of maybe one day I will be able to buy a free operating system without any connections to Google, and I would really love to have my Diaspora or Friendica or whatever app pre-installed, or maybe an app to connect anything inside the Federation. And so we need also to bundle. I mean, Facebook does it, we also need to do it. And some first steps are made. For example, there are some projects for homemade clouds where you just can buy your plug-and-play device, and you will be able to get it soon with a pre-installed version of a Diaspora pod. So it won't be the hackers anymore who have their own pod, but maybe the left activists who is protesting against neoliberal politics. And that's cool. And there's another example that cooperation really can work. When you take, for instance, Firefox. Firefox is the most used browser, at least in Germany. And Firefox has a feature. You can have included share buttons inside Firefox. And you can not only choose between Facebook and Twitter and others, but you can also choose to use Diaspora. And this kind of cooperation is something we clearly need more in order to overcome gated communities such as Facebook. So, you know, I'm an economist, so I was trained to believe in the idea of free markets and fair competition and so on. It's a bit like studying dark magic, but in fact, really, I believe that competition is at least in some areas something that makes sense. But at some points, you need to see when a market just fails so hard that it doesn't deliver the best possible solution. And I don't think it's the best possible solution if you can't really choose, if there's no competition. And there is no competition with Facebook. So it's the reason why Diaspora and the others struggle so hard is not because their idea isn't great or their technology is not the better one, maybe. But it is the openness of the web that is threatened systematically when monopolies use the network effect in order to create more and more gated communities and expand the borders of these gated communities more and more. And the inconvenient truth is also, I mean, I presented some ideas how we can overcome this, but it will remain hard as long as the structures are like they are right now. And I read one very interesting article where the journalist asked the inventor of the protocol for email attachments what would happen if this idea of email was invented today. And he replied, in this environment, if somebody invented email, whoever managed to get critical mass first would become the world's de facto email provider. Imagine such a world. I mean, it's disgusting. But right now, we have such a situation in the area of social network. Here we are. Facebook has become the world's de facto social network provider in large parts of the world. Every fifth human being on this planet logs in on Facebook at least once per month. And it has this position not because it's better than other, but only because of market dynamics and because it was lucky. There is no real competition, and this is market failure. And when Tim Berners-Lee invented the internet protocol that freed us from the gated communities of CompuServe and others, he gave it just away. He didn't say, yeah, I have this business model, it's super cool, it's based on targeted advertisement, and I will build a gated community around my internet. He gave it away for free. And because people like him gave protocols or new ideas away for free and opened it, we had this incredible development where we had so much innovation, so much creativity through these open structures. But this is not how market regulation should work. I mean, market regulation should not rely upon that someone who has the next cool big idea that can change the world for better will just be a cool person. So, finally, some people argue when we talk about social networks and the dominance of Facebook that this is only a trend. It would go away. One day all the teens switch to another network, Facebook will be gone. And I remember hearing similar things about the internet as such. It's only a trend. It will go away. But I don't think so. And I also don't think so about social networks, because social networks are a very, very powerful idea. They are super awesome. And maybe Facebook declines one day because all the teens realize that their parents are on Facebook as well. But what will be next? If the next big thing is also a gated community, nothing has changed. So in order to change things, we not only need to provide alternatives such as the Federation, Diaspora, Frenica, and so on. We need to support them because maybe you are looking for friends. Where should you go? Maybe you find interesting people on Diaspora and they really deserve our support as users, as donors, as developers, or as allies. And you should never forget that programming free software and building alternative ecosystems to what we see outside in this gated community world is also a political act. It's not only writing software, it's writing an alternative code for how we want the world to be. And there is an alternative to patent wars. There is an alternative to gated communities and to business models that only are based on exploiting our privacy. And such projects represent the visions of a better world, and that's why I would like to support them. But we also need to address, in order to win this fight, that these alternatives don't face fair competition. This is market failure on a large scale. And that is why we need to fight for open standards and in order to change the market structures that will create gated communities over and over again, we need to force Facebook, we need to force them and not just kindly ask, Mr. Zuckerberg, would you please be so kind to consider to tear down this wall? This will not work. We need to talk about political solutions. And we need to address this as a need for market regulation in order that the better solution can win. Thank you.
Yeah, tear down this wall. Yeah, Ronald Reagan at its best, at least Mr. Zuckerberg is watching the stream or Oettinger is watching the stream, you know what to do. So can we now to the questions and answers, microphones on the left, on the right, and also are there any questions from the internet?
Yes, I have two questions from the internet.
Okay, we will start with the internet because I'm sure you are here after the talk that people can ask you. So okay, dear internet.
What is the relation of Diaspora and GNU Social or Pump.io? Are there plans to merge the protocols?
Yeah, I think there for this question you would really need to ask the developers. But I can ask this room. Hey, Diaspora developers, are you here? Yeah, there. Do you want to say something about this?
Please, just when you go to the microphone, otherwise it's not here in this stream.
Yeah, a warm applause to Dennis Schubert.
So no, there are no actual plans to merge protocols, but there are discussions on defining a new protocol that supports all social networks together. So yeah.
Is there another question on? Is there another question from the internet?
Yes, is there a way to import from Facebook to Diaspora?
to import data? Yeah, this is an interesting thing. For example, I had this in my presentation, but because of out of time reasons, I deleted it. There is, fortunately, this new EU privacy law, the privacy regulation, which will also force platforms such as Facebook to provide like a data dump of your data you can take with you. But I'm still a bit not very convinced how this will work out, whether or not all the data is included. It would be very convenient if you just had one one data dump and you could just download it and upload it. But we need to wait and see how this will develop. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm sorry to hear, but at least we are out of time now. All questions afterwards with Katharina. Give her another warm applause for this fabulous talk.